So it's a huge pleasure for me to be here today to talk to the UDIA and its members in Wollongong. I have to say I've probably not had the opportunity to speak in such a dramatic location. I'm actually a little bit surprised that you're going to be able to pay attention to me, because that looks pretty inviting, but maybe the water temperature is not so great. Maybe if you live here, it all just becomes terribly familiar. So to start with today, I'm going to rest on my personal area of expertise, which is the macroeconomy. So I'm just going to give an overview of how the Australian macroeconomy has been travelling and how the drivers of economic growth have been evolving over the last couple of years. In particular, I'm going to be highlighting the growth that we've seen in non-mining business investment, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the fact that dwelling construction has gone from contributing to growth to being relatively flat. So dwelling investment's maintaining a fairly high level, but it's no longer contributing to growth. Then I'm going to turn to look at housing markets, as the title suggests, and I'm going to focus at the state level to start with. And in particular, I'm going to focus on the different drivers of housing demands and how they relate to various demographic factors. Finally, I'm going to take this process of disaggregation, having started at the national level, to the state level, one step further and have a look at some of the factors that are likely to be driving housing growth or demand for housing in the Illawarra region. So, as promised, I'll start with the macro economy. So this graph shows that GDP growth in Australia has averaged about 2.5% over the past 5 years or so. 2.5% is a little bit below our estimates of trend growth. And so what this means is that growth has been decent, but it hasn't really quite been enough to really erode the excess capacity that we have in the economy. So things like the fact that we have low and stable wage pressures and inflation are also indicators of this overall picture. If we roll forward to the March quarter 2018, which is the most recent national accounts that we've had, we can see that GDP growth picked up to about 3%. The more recent data we've had from the June quarter suggests that this positive outlook has continued. And our central forecast for GDP growth is for growth to be at or a bit above 3% over 2018 and over 2019. 3% is actually a little bit above where our estimates of trend output growth are. So what we should be seeing through this period is a reasonable decline in excess capacity in our economy and a gradual increase in wage pressures and inflation. So to understand the central forecast of 3% or a little bit above over the next couple of years, I think it's really important to look at the composition of growth and how it's changed. So what this graph does is compares the contribution to growth from different expenditure components over the year to March 2018, which is the latest data that we have, with what we saw over the year to March 2016, so basically 2 years ago. The first point that I want to highlight from this graph is, if we look at the negative bars for mining investment, is that the drag on growth from falling mining investment has been diminishing. This has played out, or this process has played out more or less as we've expected. You never get the timing of these things exactly right, but it's more or less what we've thought. And our expectation is that the process of falling mining investment from at the end of the mining investment boom will have played out by the time we get to early 2019. So a part of the reason we have confidence that growth will continue is that we have the absence of a negative, which is ultimately a positive. You can also see from this graph that the contribution from the public sector has been increasing, and some of this is related to infrastructure, and I'll get back to that topic a bit later. The other two points that I want to highlight from this graph is the significant pickup in the contribution to growth from non-mining business investment, and that's what I'll talk about in a bit more detail next, but also the fact that dwelling investment has gone from making a positive contribution to growth to being roughly flat. The pickup in non-mining business investment is really important, because it's very hard to imagine a sustainable pickup and growth without investment being a part of the story. So new investment is required to replace depreciated capital, that's sort of obvious, but it's also one of the main ways that new technology gets embodied into all the processes that go into producing and distributing the goods and services that we consume throughout the economy. So if we have a long period of weak investment growth, it can create concerns that we're laying the foundations for relatively weak productivity growth going forward. It's fair to say that we're actually a lot more confident about the prospects for non-mining business investment now than we were around 2 years ago. So if you go back to the statement on monetary policy, which is where we talk about our forecasts, in about 2015, when we were discussing the risks around our forecast, the fact that we had had weak growth in non-mining business investment was one of the topics of conversation. And we also noted that the indicators of investment intentions showed no sign that there was going to be an imminent recovery. So we were quite concerned about the fact that we'd seen weak investment growth. And that was all despite the fact that a lot of the preconditions you thought would be present for strong investment growth were there. So we knew that interest rates were low, and businesses were reporting that their business conditions were actually quite strong and well above average. So we spent quite a bit of effort trying to understand why investment growth had been so low. And if you're interested in reading a summary of that analytical work that we did, it's been produced recently in our bulletin. And just as we released our bulletin, we find that non-mining business investment's actually been picking up. Over the year to the March quarter 2018, it grew by 10% in year-ended terms. So you can see from this graph that a lot of the growth over recent years has come from the non-residential construction category. So that includes things like the construction of hotels, the construction of office buildings. It also includes things like private sector investment in infrastructure for the private sector. So it would include things like renewable energy capacity. The other category in this graph, which is the red bars, includes things like computer software and research and development. And that's also been adding noticeably to growth. We have a liaison program where we go and we talk to businesses about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And the liaison that we've done with a lot of businesses recently has been telling us that businesses are much more interested in investing in IT technology, in particular software, over recent years, to try and improve their productivity, to try and reduce their costs, and to try and improve the quality of their service delivery. So that all feels pretty consistent, that the official data and what we're getting from our liaison program are telling us the same thing. The third bar in here is machinery and equipment. And this has become increasingly important to non-mining business investment. This is one of the areas where the public infrastructure investment has been an important part of the story. Our liaison contacts have reported that the recent increase in the flow of public infrastructure work, combined with expectations that there will be quite a bit of work in the pipeline from the public sector based on commitments made by state and federal governments, have encouraged contractors in the construction industry to commit to new investments. And that's a part of this pickup in machinery and equipment. So overall, the change or the evolution towards growth coming from investment is a positive thing, and we have reasonable confidence that that will continue. So turning to housing, as I've already noted, dwelling investment has gone from making a positive contribution to growth to being more or less flat. In terms of our forecast, what's important is that although we don't expect dwelling investment to contribute much to growth, we expect it to remain at a high level for a long time. So to understand this outlook, I think what's really important is to understand there's no such thing as a national housing market. So we would typically start by looking at housing markets at the state level. And what you can see here is that there have been some similarities in the evolution of dwelling cycles, but there's also been distinct differences. So one point of similarity across states is that the construction of higher density apartments has been much more important in this dwelling cycle than it has been in the past. And I'm aware that's also been true for Wollongong and the Illawarra region. We've used our liaison program quite extensively to understand how we should adjust our forecasting processes, because we know that the process of going from a building approval to starting construction and the length of time it takes to complete a construction is a lot longer and a lot more variable for higher density construction than it is for the traditional detached dwelling construction. So I keep talking about our liaison program, and I should mention that the UDIA are in our liaison program, as are a number of its members, and I've met at least one person who has been interviewed by our liaison team in their recent visit to Wollongong in the Illawarra region. And what's really important about the liaison program and being able to visit a whole range of regions and capital cities is that it allows us to gain deeper insights into some of the specific factors that are operating at a more local level. So that allows us to appreciate some of the differences that planning rules can have on the way housing development is occurring, and it can give us an early indication of emerging capacity constraints. One of the really important differences across states has been the timing of the dwelling cycles. So you can see from this graph that for New South Wales and Victoria, the level of dwelling investment has been broadly stable at quite a high level since about 2016. In contrast, there's been a turn in the higher density construction cycle in Queensland that occurred in early 2017, and in Western Australia, residential construction peaked in mid-2015. And that's interesting from the perspective that the peak in the mining boom was about 2012. So this is the peak in the housing cycle is actually quite a bit later than the peak in mining investment. And what these differences highlight is the fact that different states experience different demand and supply conditions. Given the time constraints I have today, I'm going to focus on the demand side of this equation. So one of the really important drivers of housing demand over the longer run is the rate at which new households are formed. And that's a function of population growth and the average size, or the size of an average household. Average household size, interestingly, declined pretty steadily from the 1960s to early 2000. And that seems to have occurred alongside demographic factors such as declining fertility rates, lower marriage rates, and the ageing of the population. And what's interesting is that the average household size in aggregate has actually levelled out since 2000. So if we're going to look at things that are causing changes in demand, we have to move to population growth. The natural increase in the Australian population has declined over time, and this is also mainly due to demographic factors by definition. So what we see here is that lower fertility rates have basically offset increased life expectancy. One of the interesting things about this is that despite the fact we've had a decline in the natural rate of increase in the Australian population, this is still quite a lot stronger than what's being experienced in many other advanced economies. So when we talk about the challenges of demographic change, Australia is actually in quite a different position to many other advanced economies. But it's also clear from this graph that immigration, or net overseas migration as the title says, has been a really important feature of the population growth story. And in particular, it's been the dominant influence on the changes or the swings in population growth over the past decade. The largest single category of net overseas migration has been people on temporary student visas. Prior to the financial crisis, a large share of these students were actually coming to Australia for vocational training courses. Then there were changes to visa requirements that led to a drop-off in the numbers, but they've subsequently picked up, and most of that increase has come from students attending Australian universities. I think it's really important to put this into perspective. So for Australia, education now accounts for about 10% of aggregate exports, and that's roughly the same ballpark as our rural exports. So education is roughly as important to Australia as rural exports. From the perspective of demand for housing, what's important to note here is that most of these students have been going to Sydney and Melbourne. So another interesting category on this graph is the skilled visas. The net inflow of people on skilled visas increased in response to demand for skilled workers during the mining boom. Unsurprisingly, most of these workers went to Western Australia and Queensland. And at the same time as you have this change in immigration from other countries, you also saw flows from other Australian states and New Zealand to Western Australia and Queensland picking up. But as the mining sector transitioned from the construction phase to the production phase of the mining boom, demand for labour fell off, the number of skilled visa people declined, and the inflow of people from other Australian states and New Zealand has actually turned around to be an outflow. So as a consequence of all these factors, there have been quite large differences in the population growth rates at the state level. And these have had direct effects on the demand for housing. In terms of our forecast, population growth is expected to remain strong. That's particularly true for Victoria and New South Wales. And the net overseas migration component of that is expected to largely be driven by people coming in on student visas. So briefly turning to the supply side, the pipeline of residential construction that's been approved but not yet completed remains quite high in New South Wales and Victoria. There's also a reasonable pipeline of work in Queensland, but that's already started to decline. Based on recent approvals data and expectations for demand conditions, this suggests that dwelling investment in New South Wales and Victoria will remain at a high level for a number of years. So once again, we've used information from our liaison contacts to explain, well, why shouldn't this lead to an increase in investment activity rather than just staying at a high level? And the answer to that, particularly in New South Wales, seems to be that capacity constraints are binding. Of course, I don't want to... So these are sort of long-run factors, but there are other factors that affect demand for housing and affect formation, other than formation of households and population growth. In particular, interest rates and changes in lending standards can also change the amount that households are either willing or able to borrow and therefore spend on housing. Another way of gauging the balance of supply and demand, taking into account all the factors, is to look at housing price growth. So over the past 5 years, housing price growth has been quite subdued in Brisbane and Perth in the bottom panels. So this is quite consistent with the fact that population growth in those two states declined following the mining investment boom, at the same time as there was quite a significant increase in the supply of housing based on decisions that had been made in previous years. In contrast, housing price growth has been quite strong in Sydney and Melbourne. And this has also been where population growth has been strongest in recent years. Given that housing accounts for 55% of household assets, we pay a lot of attention to these developments and their potential implications for consumption. So now turning to how these factors play out in the Illawarra region. So from a demand perspective, the Illawarra region's also experienced an increase in population growth. Just the couple of conversations I've already had today makes that apparent. That's a very big feature of the conversation we're likely to have in the panel. Some of this comes about from overseas students attending the University of Wollongong. So some of the stories that are relevant for Sydney are also relevant for Wollongong. But it's also come from people migrating to the region from other parts of Australia, and the main source of regional immigration is actually Sydney. I'm sure that won't surprise anybody in this room. I will note that there are actually a number of people at the Reserve Bank of Australia who've migrated from Wollongong to Sydney, and we've benefited greatly from the University of Wollongong's training of economists in that regard. And what this graph shows is that the population in the Illawarra region is a little bit older on average than the population in either Sydney or Australia on average. But I think the important point to take away is that it still has a very large working age population. And this is because its geographic proximity to Sydney and the fact that the transport infrastructure allows people to commute from the Illawarra region to Sydney is an important feature of this area. So this graph shows from census data that around 20% of people living in Wollongong commute at least 50 kilometres to get to work. This is one of the highest rates in the state. Unsurprisingly, five of the areas with higher shares of people commuting more than 50 kilometres are also within commuting distance of Sydney. And if you're interested, Wollondilly is the basically captures the Camden area. I had to look that up. And this is a sort of important point to note is that Illawarra residents are also really well placed to benefit from the fact that the fastest growing areas of Sydney are in the south and the southwest. And we've already heard the word aerotropolis, but the fact that the aerotropolis around the new Badgerys Creek looks like it's imminently going to be started is also another positive for residents of the Illawarra region. And that's going to be particularly true of some of the transport infrastructure that's been proposed goes ahead. Although people from the Illawarra region can and do commute to Sydney, labour markets in the Illawarra region itself have been strong recently. And the combination of those two factors means that there's been strong employment growth for people living in the Illawarra region over the past 5 years. The unemployment rate for the Illawarra region has actually fallen to be below that of New South Wales, which in turn is the lowest state unemployment rate in the country and well below the aggregate unemployment rate for Australia. Strong population growth and the prosperity associated with strong labour markets have led to an increase in demand for housing and higher housing prices in the Illawarra region. Just as in Sydney, developers have responded to higher house prices by constructing more houses, and dwelling investment in the region has increased. Also similarly to Sydney, there's been quite a bit of debate about whether the infrastructure has been growing fast enough to accommodate the needs of this increasing population and the construction that goes with it. So just to summarise, starting from the high level, over the past couple of years, non-mining business investment is becoming a more important driver of growth in the Australian economy. And this is a really good thing because that investment is necessary to ensure future productivity growth. And future productivity growth is ultimately what sits underneath the economic prosperity and welfare of the Australian people. Infrastructure investment, from mainly by the public sector but increasingly from the private sector, has been a part of this story. At the same time, dwelling investment growth has eased off. Although the level of dwelling investment is expected to remain at a high level, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, it's not likely to contribute much to growth over the next couple of years. Demand for housing is likely to remain strong because population growth is expected to remain strong. But the housing story is different across different states and across different regions within states. And that's partly because population trends differ. And one of the best illustrations of this point is the population and housing trends that we've seen in Western Australia over the course of the mining investment boom, both the up phase and the down phase. The data show that population trends and housing market developments in the Illawarra region are perhaps unsurprisingly quite closely linked to those of Sydney. And that's partly because the transport infrastructure allows people in the Illawarra region to commute to Sydney. Future transport infrastructure plans and the development associated with Badgerys Creek are likely to strengthen those ties. As always, the key to effective urban development is high quality, transparent cost-benefit analysis of potential infrastructure projects. And I think it's really important to note how important local context is for making good decisions about infrastructure. The UDIA is one organisation that has a huge role to play in this debate. I think it's also important to highlight the fact that the UDIA and its members in Wollongong and in other parts of the country also have an important role to play in informing macroeconomic policy. And that's through informing the bank about what the factors are at play in different housing markets. And that's basically the point of our liaison program. So I'd like to encourage you all, if we approach you, to please be forthcoming with information. We do listen and we do try to understand these differences, because ultimately they're important to how we forecast the economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex, for all of that. There was a lot of information there, but on the whole it still looks positive, which will encourage us greatly down here. Now, Alex has kindly offered to take any questions. If anyone has any question they'd like to ask, please raise your hand, and there are microphones.
Thanks, Alex. Lawson Fredericks from the Fountaindale Group. You touched very briefly there on the issue of availability of finance, and that's obviously key for the development industry because it drives the whole industry. And on the ground, we're starting to see some ramifications from the Banking Royal Commission and bankers changing their lending criteria. Is the RBA seeing any of that or tracking that, and have any expectations of what impact that might have on the economy and the housing market?
Yep. So there's clearly been quite a few regulatory changes, for example, and the banks themselves have been looking at their risk management practices and their lending practices, and the decisions are basically around tightening lending standards when it comes to lending for housing. That's been particularly focused on investor housing and interest-only loans in investor housing. So to the extent that that affects the marginal borrower and the amount that the marginal borrower can borrow, that will have an effect on demand for housing. So we do pay a lot of attention to these developments, and I guess there's two aspects to that. So one is what are the consequences of that for the credit growth and therefore demand for housing and sort of the real economic side of things. And in that respect, we have done quite a lot of work trying to understand how many people might be affected by these changes. And the question ultimately comes down to, you know, that's a supply side effect, but there's also demand side effects happening at the same time. So it's always a little bit difficult to tease apart which of the factors is most important at any point in time. I think the other aspect of it that's really important to bear in mind is that we also have responsibilities for the financial stability. And from that perspective, it's really important that lending practices are appropriate, that banks are doing a good job of managing the risks that they face, because ultimately that's going to be what underpins the strength of the financial system and the ability of it to support growth going forward. So I think there's sort of two aspects that we pay a lot of attention to and try to understand.